You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 8th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Kara is not joining us this week because she's feeling a little under the weather. She needed a week off from yesterday.
Feeling a bit poorly.
Yeah. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good.
Better than Kara. I'm here.
The weather broke, right? So we're moving into cooler days now, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's been nice. We've had some beautiful, beautiful days.
Here comes the fall soon.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, talking to my wife, trying to figure out, like, are we going to go apple picking? Are we going to go to the Renaissance Fair? You know, we're just trying to see, like, if it's safe to do some of the fall stuff that we do.
Well, apple picking, you don't have to come within 50 feet of anybody when you do that.
Right.
And I suppose if they come near you, you could throw apples, you know?
Yeah, you could throw
always. That's always an option.
Yeah, even if they don't try to come near you.
That's right.
All right, so we got a couple of bits of COVID news that I wanted to go over.
Here we
go.
There's a slew of possible new variants that I want to talk about very quickly.
So a slew of variants? Is that the right?
The World Health Organization.
It's a murder of variants, I think.
Don't say that.
Okay. Cornucopia of variants?
Panoply.
Cornucopia? Panoply of variants. There we go.
A pod. A school of variants.
A Loki of variants.
A variety of variants.
Nope, that's it. Done. We've decided. A Loki of variants. Perfect.
Oh, Loki.
Right now, the Delta variant of SARS-CoV-2 is responsible for greater than 99% of COVID infections. Basically taken over. It's twice as infectious as the baseline variant, and it's just outcompeted. Basically, all other variants.
Well, but isn't that good, though? Isn't it good in the sense that if you're going to have a variant and you're going to, and it's going to be highly communicative, it's good that it's not like super deadly. It's not really, there's really no evidence to show that it's deadlier. So isn't it going to be harder for any other variant to supersede this unless it's
it's not technically deadlier, but it does, you know, a lot of people do get a larger inoculum because there's so much of the virus.
Right.
And kids are getting it more, and kids are more likely to get hospitalized if they get it. So it's not totally...
I hear you, but
equivalent in terms of deadliness.
I hear you, but my big fear is that, you know, that a variant will come out that will just completely wipe out the vaccination, it's not even there, and be far deadlier. I mean, that's right. That's a worst-case scenario.
Yeah, so like now that the Delta variant has basically taken over, we get a variant of the Delta variant that adds... increased fatality or something.
That would be horrible, but even that wouldn't necessarily spread like wildfire. You know, I don't think we're going to have anything that's going to take over and eclipse the Delta variant like Delta eclipsed the one that was primary one before it.
We don't know. So the World Health Organization has two categories of variants. One is called a variant of interest, and that's just one that they're keeping an eye on because it has properties that could be associated with some kind of gain of function of the virus. So either increased infectivity, increased virulence, or immune escape, vaccine escape, or increased deadliness, something like that, right? And this is based upon, these mutations may have the one or more of these properties. A variant of concern is the next level, and that's one that has actually demonstrated any of those properties. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, are there any of those?
So right now, there's alpha, beta, gamma, delta are the four variants of concern, you know, with delta now being dominant. But there's a number of variants of interest, you know, that they're keeping their eye on that haven't really broken out yet, but again, they're worth tracking. So the variants of interest are eta, iota, kappa, lambda, and mu. So that's five.
You just said there's five new variants?
There's five. Well, there's tons of variants, Jay. There's like hundreds, thousands of variants. These are variants of interest. So there's four variants of concern, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. There's five variants of interest. So these have genetic changes that are predicted to have characteristics that would not be good, such as increased transmissibility, increased disease severity, immune escape, diagnostic and therapeutic escape, you know, vaccine escape, anything of those. And they need to be spreading somewhere. You know, they need, you know, obviously if the variant is not spreading at all, then it's not a variant of interest. So the most recent one Moo is probably the most concerning because this one has mutations in the spike protein, and it's possible that this variant will not be covered by the vaccine. Although it's probably not any more deadly or infectious, but this one they're concerned about essentially immune escape. So, for example, you know, while the Delta variant is spreading like wildfire through the unvaccinated, you know, the concern is that a variant like the Mu variant might start spreading through the vaccinated population because it's not being significantly blocked by the vaccine. So the one thing so far, the Mu variant is not outcompeting Delta, right? So it's spreading. It's like almost 40% in Colombia where it started. It's about 0.1% worldwide. It's 0.2% of infections in the U.S. And so it's just it's so far seems to be outcompeted by the Delta variant. But if it the concern is that it will be more resistant to the vaccine. And once the Delta variant burns itself out and or more people get infected or vaccinated, you know, a Mu variant, you know, or something close to it will then spread through the vaccinated population. So we're not done with these variants yet. You know, again, this is not a reason to panic. These are just variants of interest at this point in time. They haven't actually demonstrated that they're doing this. It's not, they haven't been escalated to a variant of concern at this point. But this, you know, if we want to be looking down the road at what might be coming at us, this is the list to keep track of. So we'll see. You know, I hope 6 months from now or something we're not experiencing what we're experiencing now, but with just newer variants. Yeah.
Anything we can do to prepare, test it, you know, experiment, see what these variants can potentially do at this point? Or we have to just kind of wait.
No, that's what they do. Whenever they identify new variants like this, they sequence them, look at the mutations, they see what change it makes to the protein, how does this change the property of the virus, and try to predict, you know, what that would mean. And then they look epidemiologically at what it's doing in the population where it was first identified. But they have to kind of wait and see what it does out there in the wild. You know, like with the Mu variant, the big question was, is it going to start to displace Delta, or is it going to remain on the fringe because Delta is more competitive than it is? And that's what seems to be happening. It's not taking off like Delta did. So that's not what the nature of this variant is. But again, it still has properties that are not good.
Well, has Delta displaced the original SARS-19?
99%+. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the base of the virus displaced now is the Delta variant.
Right.
Right. So what can we do? Get vaccinated. That's it. Mm-hmm. Okay, everyone needs to get vaccinated. When your third dose and or booster become available, get that. So some good news is that in Israel, where they've already significantly started giving out their booster shots, their virus numbers are going way down, especially hospitalizations and deaths.
The third shot.
Yeah.
Linked directly to boosters.
Well, it correlates, you know, with the booster shot. So, I mean, the thing is, we, you know, the vaccine is our off ramp from this pandemic. If we want to take it, that's it.
Right.
We just need everybody to do it. You know,
I'm happy that, you know, my kids went back to school last week. So they've been in school, you know, a week and a half. You know, no emails yet. Your kid's been exposed or any of that nonsense. Like, it's been, you know, zero of that. So I'm feeling pretty good that, like, in Connecticut, you know, with the amount of people that are vaccinated, you know, it's not going to turn into a shit show for us. But again, you know, this is kind of like waiting for that bad asteroid to show up that is on a trajectory to Earth. Like, it just takes that, you know, that one mutation where we get something that's horrible, and there's so many people that have it, that mutations are bound to happen. You know, how worried are you about that, Steve? Like, you know, should we be frightened about what the next year has to offer us?
Well, I mean, like, in several steps along the way, what we've said was, don't panic, but be concerned. You know, we said that at the very beginning, if you remember, of this pandemic. It's like, before we knew what was going to happen, like, it's not time to panic yet, but you should definitely keep an eye on this. This is something to be concerned about. And, you know, it turned out to be much worse than anybody thought. So it's, you know, this is still an active pandemic, you know, and anything can happen. These variants are so hard to predict because we don't know how they're going to interact and exactly what properties they're going to have and which new ones are going to emerge, that, you know, we just can't say. I don't think we know where we're going to be a year from now. Now, most experts, the majority of experts who were surveyed about this said that, yeah, pretty much this is going to become endemic. You know, that's the emerging consensus. It's like we've missed our window to get rid of, you know, this virus, and we're relegated to the fringes. So what's going to happen is we're going to slide into, you know, probably, again, I don't know how many more like serious waves we're going to hit in the meantime, but we're going to slide into a situation where we're just living with this virus. It's, the pandemic is never going to really end, ever. Just like we're still in the middle of an ongoing flu pandemic that just moves around the world every year, you know. But, you know, the flu is seasonal, so that sort of sets up a pattern to it, where, you know, whereas the coronavirus is less so. But, and then, you know, we're going to have to just maintain our vaccination status, whatever that's going to mean, whether it's going to, you know, hopefully it'll settle into something like an annual shot. Just get that with your flu shot. And I think that, while we're not, we obviously can't permanently, you know, partially shut down the economy, but I suspect that we're never going to get to pre-pandemic behavior. You know, in terms of, you know, I think there's going to, you know, for example, I would not be surprised if, as a healthcare, you know, worker, that hospital workers just wear masks now, and that's never going to go back. Remember, after the SARS virus in about a decade ago in China, since then, and where they, it really was an epidemic that hit China, it didn't really become like a worldwide pandemic. But you know, the Chinese government told their citizens, you know, mask wearing is a standard precaution, you know, in the middle of the epidemic. And they really never stopped doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It just became part of Chinese culture that if you're in a really crowded place, you wear a mask. And I think that we're just going to become part of the background now, this sort of heightened vigilance towards spreading and contracting respiratory illnesses, you know, viruses. Right. I mean, it's hard to imagine now. Could you imagine being shoulder to shoulder in a crowd with a bunch of unmasked strangers? You know, like we talked about Dragon Con. Every year we go to Dragon Con, you get the con crud, right? You walk away with some virus. Like there's no way you're spending 3 days walking through crowds with 100,000 people and not walking away with a couple of viruses.
Mm-hmm.
So what's that going to mean in the future if one of those viruses is COVID? To some extent, we're going to rely on our vaccinated status. But I think, you know, there's going to be some semi-permanent changes in behavior. Like I might decide, oh, you know, if I'm going to go into this particular crowd, I'm going to wear an N95 mask, you know.
Yeah.
Or, if, you know, those kind of events may be more likely to happen outdoors than indoors or whatever. Well, it'll be interesting to see what things are going to be like in 10 years, you know, what the persistent changes are going to be. But I bet you there are going to be some. We're never going to go back fully to pre-COVID.
Yeah, that ship has sailed.
So therefore, it's likely that at some point we're going to catch, everyone will catch this, some variant. They will catch it.
I haven't had the flu in 20 years.
I haven't had it either.
Because I get vaccinated every year.
Never had it.
You know, so I'm hoping that with vaccinations and precautions that, you know, I'll never get it. You know, that's my plan. I will see how successful I am. But, you know, that I think that's, but I do think that a large portion of the population will get it at some point. But again, if you are vaccinated and you get it, it's overwhelmingly likely that you'll have a mild infection. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's fine. It's just going to be very hard to live in the world going forward without being vaccinated. I know that there are people who want to do that, but they're insane. Wow. I mean, it's just nuts to think that that's going to be a viable strategy.
I know.
Similar situation to the flu vaccine, where we just sort of accepted 30,000 deaths a year in the U.S. And whatever that translates to worldwide, just sort of accept that's part of life, you know. And now what's our acceptance level going to be in 10 years? Are we going to accept, we lose 30,000 people to the flu. We lose 100,000 people to the coronavirus. That's just the background now. I don't know. Is that going to be it, or is it going to be, all right, I'm really, I got the sniffles, I'm staying home. I'm working from home today, and like, there's no questions asked. If you're like, hey, I got a little bit of sore throat or fever, nobody's going to pressure you into coming into work. They're like, Dan, yeah, take 3 days working from home, you know, or whatever. So I do, you know, I think there's going to be some cultural changes.
You know, Steve, I had a hope that this Delta variant wave was going to scare a lot of people who weren't previously, like, you know, whose lives weren't previously already hit or changed by the first wave of COVID. But I'm starting to see evidence that the anti-vaxxers, for whatever, however someone has become an anti-vaxxer, it's not penetrating. You know, I know people who got COVID that are anti-vaxxers and they're not getting back, you know, they're still anti-vax even after they get it.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think it's going to do much to change the world. So, you know, I think that you nailed it, man. We're going to be dealing with this in the background forever.
Well, I mean, in terms of the vaccines, I mean, I don't know. We need to figure out some way to depoliticize this because politicizing something like a basic public health measure like this is crazy. It's just very counterproductive, very harmful. But also, it's very polarizing because what I've again, having dealt with things like anti-vaxxers for the last 30 years, there's definitely an attitude change in the culture. Because now, if you are not an anti-vaxxer, you are pissed at anti-vaxxers. Like, really, really upset at them and mad at them. And,
yeah,
like, to an extent I've never seen before. Never. Like, this is really polarized society. You can't blame people, but it's just, it's a bad place to be because it's made it so polarizing.
Yeah, Steve, I don't know if you saw that. There's a viral article today, which is basically, you know, raging against anti-vaxxers and making some good points, but it had so much use of the F word, it was almost too much. They're throwing F bombs everywhere. All sorts of these like curses and to these anti-vaxxers. It really seemed like it was a cathartic thing for the writer to do, and it was funny to read. And some of it was well written, but it was just kind of this funny thing, like a kind of like, you know, encapsulating what you just said about this rage against the anti-vaxxers in one article. You know, because cursing them out every other sentence, it was quite funny, but telling.
Yeah, I mean, if we could find a way to use that rage in order to move the needle, in order to, you know, get more people vaccinated, get better regulation, you know, I think we need vaccine mandates, absolutely.
Yep. Oh,
we need to turn that into political action, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be easy. Let's move on to some news items. Jay, is it good strategic manipulation to price things like the 1995, just under a cutoff like that?
Sure. Psychological pricing, sure.
Well, the answer now is it depends because new research, we just had a study done that shed some light on this. What we're talking about is this idea that, I'll do this in US dollars just because I can do it easier in my head. So as an example, let's say that a company has a product and instead of them charging $20, they charge $19.99. You know, now $19.99, you know, you've seen it on TV. Mm-hmm. All of the .99 products out there, they're everywhere. You can see them, you know, go on Amazon, you'll see a ton of them. This, of course, is marketing manipulation. Mm-hmm. The 19 simply just sounds less than the 20, but of course the cost difference is one penny. So it is $20. And some consumers certainly do respond to this kind of marketing. I bet I have. You know, I mean, why not? Researchers at Ohio State University's Fisher College of Business, led by Juna Kim, found that this pricing trick can also have the opposite effect on consumers.
But Jay, before you go on to that, you know what that cognitive bias is called?
Tell me.
It's a leftmost digit bias. And it actually makes sense because it's a way that it's a mental shortcut, right? We estimate the value of things. One way to do that is you just look at the leftmost digit, and that's estimate of the overall order of magnitude of the number that you're estimating, right?
That makes perfect sense.
It's just being exploited. So if numbers were random, it would not be a bad method of estimation. But if someone is deliberately manipulating the numbers so it's 1995 or 1999, then they're taking advantage of that tendency to do that. And it works because that's sort of a built-in bias that we have.
This is also called the just below pricing. So it's just below pricing, right? Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So companies all have to figure out what people will pay for their products. It's a common task, you know, this pricing measure. They have to change the price. They test it. They figure out like where do we fit in? They compare themselves to other manufacturers. But ultimately, you know, they want to charge as much as they can for what the consumer will pay for the product. So let's say you're selling a Hoosiwatzer for $19.99, right? Hoosiwatzer is anything you want it to be. The next model of that Hoosiwatzer up, which is a little bit better than the 1999 one, is $26.
The Hoosiwatzer 3000.
Right. Now, compare this price difference to a scenario where the low cost of the Hoosiwatzer is $20 and the high price is $26, right? There's a penny difference here, just so you know. So scenario one, $19.99 versus $26. Scenario two, $20 versus $26. The $19.99 price point seems much lower in this scenario. And Steve gave us the reason why, because of that left number bias. The researchers found that crossing the round number threshold, right? So you're going from $19.99 to a dollar, like to the 20, that's a round number. Crossing that threshold can be a big problem for upselling to more expensive options. This round number threshold effect worked in all product categories they tested. They had seven different categories in total. And one of the tests was coffee pricing. Now, let me give you a real-world example of what they did. I think you'll find this interesting. The researchers set up a coffee stand at their university, and they started by selling a small coffee for 95 cents and a large coffee for $1.20. 29% of the coffee customers upgraded to the larger cup. So they saw the 95%, and 29% of those people said, I'll go for the $1.20 version. Then they changed the prices to $1 for the small and $1.25 for the large. 56% of the customers paid for the large when they did that because there was no round number threshold that they had a breakthrough.
Right. Even though the absolute amount was higher and the difference was higher, it was a 25 cent increase versus a 21 cent increase.
Yeah. So right? When you think about that, it's in that moment, in that quick moment where the consumer is making that decision, that round number changed their decision making clearly by these percentages. It's right there in front of us. So this means they sold more expensive large cups of coffee when the small cup was above a dollar. And this means that consumers see the price difference as greater when they cross the round number barrier. It's mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. This same behavior happens with much more expensive items and with multiple upgrade levels, not just small to large. Interestingly, this idea of crossing a barrier has an effect on other things humans do. Like researchers found that if a person has to cross a state line, the destination, what? It seems farther away.
Mm-hmm.
You go 5 miles south, that's the state you live in. You go 5 miles north and you have to cross into the next state. And unconsciously, you feel like it's farther away. The round number and the state boundary line have similar emotional sway on people. So the researchers explain in part why this happens. With product pricing, consumers don't typically have any legitimate idea about what something should cost. I happen to agree with that statement because when you really think about it, you know, go on Amazon, you know, what do you actually know about what it costs to make an HDMI cable for your TV? How much does it really cost to make it? I think you would be shocked to find out that it probably costs less than a dollar to make a cable that you're paying $25 for.
Are you talking about raw materials? Are you talking about everything, the overhead that's involved?
Everything. Everything. Like ridiculously overpriced, huge profit margins. But we're just accustomed to paying, you know, somewhere around $25, you know, $15 to $25, depending on the length for an HDMI cable. Consumers will use their gut to determine if a price seems legit or not. We try to find context. When we shop on Amazon, we can easily search for similar items, right? We load our heads with price information and rating comparisons, and this helps us make a decision. When you do that, you are doing a little bit of market research to find out, like, what's going on? You know, is this a good price or not? That's good. It's not going to – And even if you do know, wow, this HDMI cable costs $1 to make, you're not going to get it for a dollar anywhere. You're still going to have to pay the markup. It's just how much are you going to pay for it? So the threshold crossing effect, however, doesn't work on consumers who have legitimate pricing information. Like, for example, someone who purchases airline tickets all the time, right? you purchase them all the time. You know what the ebb and flow is of the prices. You know what a good deal is versus a bad deal. So if they put a price up that's $19.99 or $199, that's going to be meaningless to the educated consumer that is you know, aware of what the pricing is.
Yes, but how much is your time worth? Obviously, if you're buying a house or a car, you're going to do the research. You know, if you're making a major in, you know, expenditure, but there's some threshold for everybody. Like if you're spending less than $100 on something, are you really going to spend hours researching it so that you can shave $5 off the price that you end up paying for it or whatever? You know what I mean? It's a time investment thing. Mm-hmm.
That's but a personal
major purchases,
thing.
I invest so much time in researching any significant purchase before I get to a comfort
level. I just don't want it to be crap. I just don't want to buy a bad product more so than the cost itself, just relying on
it's
cost.
Both of those things. It's quality, but also, you know, the appropriateness of the pricing.
Same thing with me, Evan. Like if I know that something is superior, like this brand has great ratings, you know, there's 30,000 ratings on this HDMI cable, I'll spend a good chunk more money to get what I feel is a superior product.
Yeah, and we have to be a little careful of that as well. We've talked about the rating system, especially on Amazon before, right. And it's not always what it appears to be.
It can
be manipulated in a lot of different ways.
It sucks,
too. So it's good to go to multiple sources and do additional research that way from various websites instead
right,
of just
Ev.
Relying on one website.
But Jay, you're right. So for most slow to medium purchases, we use our gut instinct and not like extensive knowledge and research like we do for we should be doing for more expensive purchases. And so that's where a lot of the manipulation happens, because if you're selling a million units, you know, tweaking exactly how many pennies you can extract out of the consumers matters. The other big cognitive bias that they exploit, other than this you know, left number bias, is anchoring.
Mm-hmm.
This is the now how much would you pay approach, right?
That's Ronco, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Would you say, you know, would you pay $100 for this? They're anchoring you when they do that. Would you pay $50? How about $19.95? Now, if they just came in, if they said, would you spend $5 for this? $10? How about $19.95? A completely different reaction.
Yeah,
completely different reaction. Then they anchor you at a high price, and then they hit you with a low price, or they anchor you with, would you spend $20, you know, whatever, for this product? What if we double it and give you two? You know, they increase the value, the perceived
but
value.
Wait.
Yeah, Steve, but I got to have two more of those old wine bottle glass cutters. I have to have two of those.
Right. That's why it's always a good idea, if in any kind of negotiation, to do the opening bid and to like completely either lowball or highball, depending on what side of the equation you're on. Because it anchors all later negotiation.
Without a doubt.
You know?
So one more thing, Steve. The researchers say that consumer perceptions are frequently flawed. This goes right in line with what you're saying.
Yeah.
Trusting your gut is not good enough. As consumers, we need to do legitimate price comparisons and product research. Most importantly, we need to rely on the actual numbers and not our perception of them, right? So don't let $19.99 affect you. Don't let any numbers that they throw at you. You have to do research and find actual numbers. Like, and just as a side note, in the case of buying a car, you can look up what the dealers are paying for those cars.
Mm-hmm.
You can find out like real numbers, like what are they paying to get that from the manufacturer.
It's gotten much easier to correctly price cars than it was 20, 25 years, a generation ago.
Without a doubt. Another thing you could do, I just have to throw this out there, Steve, because it's fascinating. Mm. So Bob and I, like you said, you know, Steve was looking for a car. Bob and I are looking for a car now. You know, there's one thing I found out that you can do. You can find a company that professionally buys a car for you.
This a broker?
A broker. It's fascinating. Because they know everything, right? Because they're super educated. They know every little trick that the dealers pull. They know exactly what they should be able to get it for. And they go in, like you pay this company, what, $200, $300, $400 to do the negotiating for you. And they could save you thousands of dollars on buying a new car. If you find a person that's legit, because there are some.
Yeah, as long as they represent you and they're not in collusion with the companies
right.
that they're trying to buy the product from, like the car.
You could use like Google ratings to find some good companies around you. But that's it. You, if you do that, you could save thousands of dollars. So there's smart ways to buy everything.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Bombas Socks.
Lots of things can make your workouts hard, trust me, but your socks shouldn't. That's why Bombas performance socks are built to be nothing but comfortable and supportive. Bombas performance socks have taken all the amazing innovations that make Bombas the most comfortable socks you've ever worn and added their special Hextech performance technology. Bombas performance socks are stitched with special moisture wicking yarn and temperature regulating vents that allow cool air flow in and prevent overheating.
And just so you know, for every pair of Bombas socks you buy, they donate one pair. And I'll tell you, we had a listener email us asking, hey, is this real? Are you guys really wearing these socks? Do you really like them? Yes, the answer is yes. We all own them. Mm-hmm. I just made another order again for my wife. They're awesome.
Go to bombas.com/skeptics today and get 20% off your first order. That's bombas.com/skeptics for 20% off.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. So, Bob, tell us about this new record in the strength of magnetic fields.
MIT researchers have met their goal of a 20 Tesla superconducting magnet, which is the most powerful magnet of its kind, which they say should put them on their path for a working fusion test reactor in 2025. So this is definitely, it seems, the year for fundamental advances for fusion. I talked recently about one advance. This one is from the MIT CSA researchers, which believe they've overcome the last fundamental technological hurdle to make fusion really happen in a lab. And it's really all about the magnets. Using a magnetic field is really, right, it's one obvious path for an Earth-based fusion. When you realize that fusion here would need to happen at about 100 million degrees. It's got to be very, you know, because we're not at the sun, it needs to be much, much hotter. So, you know, that's so high that it doesn't even really matter if I meant Fahrenheit or Celsius, right? 100 million degrees. Fahrenheit or Celsius doesn't matter because they're both wicked hot. Now, the resulting super hot plasma obviously could not be held, right, in any container, even if it was made of Krell metal, right? Right, Steve? Right, Jay?
Right.
Even if Krell metal, though, wouldn't melt, it still wouldn't work. Because of the physical contact. You know, you can't have physical contact with any solid container or the plasma will cool down and basically defeating the entire purpose. So, and you don't have a huge gravity well like the sun to hold it in place. And Wingardium Leviosa, that's not going to work. You can't just toss that spell around. So some type of magnetic field seems like a great way to contain the plasma, right? They've made that decision decades ago. Sure, that's obvious. And they've been working on it ever since. What we've learned, though, is the most common shape for a magnetic field, one that would probably work the best, is the donut variety, right? In a device called a tokamak. Probably heard that term tossed around a lot. Right. Now the ITER project in France, that I think is probably one of the most well-known fusion projects in the world. It's huge. They're building an immense tokamak that uses low-temperature superconductors. And these type of superconductors are good, but they can only sustain so much current. And that then limits the strength of the magnetic field, and that's not good. You don't want to do anything in your design to limit the strength of the magnetic field, but they're kind of committed to that design. So to get around that is that they have to make it extremely big, very, very, it's huge. It's going to be the biggest one ever. And that, of course, means it's more expensive. And then that means that, well, we got to have a lot more international partners now because so everybody could chip in. And that makes it even more complex, resulting in delays after delays after delays. And now they estimate that they might be ready in 2035. It seems forever from now. MIT has joined with startup company Commonwealth Fusion Systems for a while now, CFS. They're using the latest superconducting magnetic field technology, which creates a much more powerful field. And with it, they can match the performance of a device 40 times larger. It's really remarkable, this technology. They say they're on schedule for a 2025 demonstration plant they call Spark. I really like their plan. It makes a lot of sense for commercializing these plants as soon as possible. So here's a quote from Martin Greenwald, Deputy Director and Senior Research Scientist at the MIT Plasma Science and Fusion Center. He says, unlike some of the other designs for fusion experiments, the niche that we are filling was to use conventional plasma physics and conventional tokamak designs and engineering, but bring it to this new magnet technology. So we weren't requiring innovation in a half dozen different areas. We would just innovate on the magnet and then apply the knowledge base of what's been learned over the last decades. Right? So that's what they did. They didn't have to have all these other breakthroughs to make the best technology that they could imagine. They were using the knowledge we've gained over the decades, and they were applying that tried and true design they were just kind of applying it to the new magnetic field technology, and that's the only thing that required really the breakthroughs is their new magnets, and they just finished it. They just completed it. Because all of their papers, I was looking at some of their papers, all of their papers were saying that if they can get a magnetic field at 20 Teslas, then their design will work. That's what their papers said. So they had a 3-year plan 3 years ago. They made a plan to create a 20 Tesla magnet, and that's exactly what they did. So what is a Tesla in this context? It's not the man. It's not the car. It's not the coil. Tesla is essentially a unit of measurement for the strength of a magnetic field. Very high level. That's basically what it is. Now, these fields are all over the universe. Some of them are really tiny. You want to know a real tiny one? How about one picotesla? 10,
ooh, that's
10 to the minus 12 Tesla. Steve, what magnetic field is one picotesla?
The magnetic field surrounding a living cell?
Human brain. Human brain's magnetic field is one picotesla. I love picotesla so much. Now, Earth's magnetic field, they describe that as having a magnetic flux density of 50 microtesla. That's 0.00005 Tesla. Really tiny. A fridge magnet, 0.001 Tesla.
Ooh.
An average MRI magnet, which we know are powerful, right? You can't go in there with your metal watch on, 1.5 Tesla. At the very top, if you go to the other end of the spectrum, you have a magnetar with 100 gigatesla, 100 billion, 100 billion Tesla.
I knew you'd
like
it.
That, Evan. At 100 billion Tesla, don't go near that. That will deform your atoms into cigar shapes. The electron clouds around your atoms will stop working normally, making chemistry as we know it impossible. As we know it, maybe some cool chemistry will come out of that, but don't do it because your chemistry will stop. So yeah, Teslas are cool. So now the magnet that they had the breakthrough on, that they really tweaked over the last 3 years. So they're using, like I said, MIT, CSA are using cutting edge, high temperature superconductor magnets using, they call it REBCO, which stands for rare earth barium copper oxide. Critical materials for these magnets. So the intensity of the magnetic field is much higher with these. And that's critical because this is really the nub of it right here, because power density varies with the fourth power of the magnetic field. So that means if you double the magnetic field intensity, you basically are going to get the performance of a machine that's four times larger. So that's one of the reasons why they're really pushing to have the highest, most intense magnetic field that they can. The new magnets that they developed were made of 16 plates on top of each other, kind of like a Tesla orgy. Each plate, by the way, if you just took one of those 16 plates out, you would be holding in your hands the most powerful high temperature superconducting magnet in the world. Each one is, and they put 16 of them on top of each other. And the high temperature superconductor material looks like a thin ribbon. I'd love to see that stuff. So now in the future, after this breakthrough, the next step is to construct the Spark reactor, which is a smaller scale version of the ARC power plant that's going to be the commercial plant. So if Spark is successful, then they know that they can go with a full scale commercial fusion power plant, and that it should be practical. But it's still not going to be easy. You know, I know I really sell this stuff and I'm really optimistic. But it's still not going to be easy. Even now that they've made this last hurdle, this last big hurdle with these magnets, and they're on their way to making the Spark reactor, there's still so many things that they need to get right. Right? Because it needs to be reliable. They need to be able to create a sustained reaction. And if you can't make them cost effective, then what you're going to have is, their design is just going to be a lab curiosity. You know, they'll have their like Spark reactor and it works and it's great, but it's just not worth it to make thousands of them. You know, if it's not cost effective, it's not going to be commercialized. And at least that design anyway, that specific design won't be practical. And that's it. It's a lab curiosity. And so that's possible. That's absolutely possible. This is, you know, a hellishly complex engineering feat that they're doing here. It's amazing stuff that they're doing, but the jury is still out if this is going to be something that's really going to help contribute to climate change and really help out. But I hope that they can get this to work and in a way that there will be thousands of these in 15, 20 years all over the world. But of all of the projects that are out there, from ITER to the MIT CSA here, I think this team here, MIT CSA, I think their project, I'm putting my money on them. I think they probably have the best shot. And I love the idea that they want to do this ASAP. They even have a cool t-shirt. It says Fusion Energy, smaller, smarter, sooner. And that's how we need to do these things. Exactly that way. Smaller, smarter, sooner. Thank you. I am done.
Right. So this is not enough to get us across the finish line, but it's like a prerequisite. We need super powerful magnets.
Right.
To
make yes, we need them. And for this project, it was the linchpin. This was the critical thing that all of their research said that if you make these magnets, they will come. You know, if you make them, then the designs that you have, the tried and true designs for plasma physics, tokamak, all that, they will work. They will work, and you will have net energy. And three times the amount of energy they put in, they're going to get out. That's what their research is saying. That this should work. And fingers crossed. This is something I've been waiting decades, most of my life for. And I think they have the best shot.
You like Mr. Sparkman?
Nice. Touche.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Okay, Evan, I understand that on Mars, we finally have some rock.
There is rock on Mars, and it has been verified. Well, do you guys remember millions of years ago?
Oh.
You know, and asteroids and other space rocks collided into the surface of Mars with enough force to eject pieces of its crust into orbit?
Yeah.
And then do you remember how those pieces of Martian crust would float away in space, a few of them eventually finding their way into Earth's gravity to become Martian meteorites, and then they'd strike the Earth's surface to be found sometime later by wandering farmers and meteorite hunters? Do you remember that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Those were the good old souls, weren't they? Souls are days in Mars. You have to use the correct terminology here.
Oh, well, I see. It's a joke.
But... As of a few days ago, we no longer need to rely on the randomness of planetary collisions and the physics of orbital mechanics and gravity to get our Martian rock samples. Because the other day, Perseverance, the rover on Mars, it made another attempt at drilling and collecting a rock core sample. Now, if you remember, about a month ago, the first attempt was made, but it failed to capture the sample. It drilled, but it couldn't capture it. But they made an attempt again the other day, and it was successful. They confirmed it. They have it on camera. Perseverance, boring the hole in the Martian rock, removed a core sample about the thickness of a number two pencil, and only a number two pencil, and successfully stored it in a titanium container, airtight, locked up forever and nigh. A first time ever that we've collected a sample ourselves from Mars. It's beautiful. It was retrieved from a site at Jezero Crater, where there was once a huge ancient lake. So we hope we're going to learn a lot more about that. And over the course of these experiments or these collections, they hope to gather 30 such samples. NASA and the ESA, which is the European Space Agency, they're planning a series of future missions to return the rover sample tubes to Earth for closer study. The samples are going to be the first set of scientifically identified and selected materials returned to our planet from another. So that's awesome. We're not going to see them for a little while, though. This is going to take place in probably the early 2030s, they're suggesting. So we're not going to see that sample. We're going to have it in our gloved hands anytime soon. But it was captured, confirmed, and it's great. So we will eventually have it. Now, along with identifying and collecting the samples of rocks and the regolith, yes, Bob, regolith on Mars.
Yes.
And while searching for signs of ancient microscopic life, Perseverance mission includes studying this particular region to understand the geology and ancient habitability of the area, as well as to characterize the past climate. So we're going to learn a whole bunch from having gathered these samples and all the other work that Perseverance and its many instruments are doing. The robotic arm cored a hole into a flat briefcase-sized Mars rock that they nicknamed Rochette, R-O-C-H-E-T-T-E. And after completing the coring process, and it's so cool, if you look the pictures, you find them online, it's a bored hole in a rock. It's as if someone was there with a drill and just put it right in. It's so cool to see. They completed the coring process, and then the arm maneuvered the corer, the bit and the sample tube, so that the Mastcam Z camera instrument could image the contents of the still unsealed tube and transmit the results back to Earth. So this is also very cool how we're able to make the confirmation in, I won't say real time, but as close to real time as I think we possibly as possibly can. After they confirmed the core's rock presence in the tube, they sent a command to complete the processing of the sample. However, guys, there was a bit of a, well, I won't say controversy. I will say that it was a bit of a, they took a deep breath. Because during the cleaning process, what happens is the drill vibrates the tube in 5 one-second bursts. And what this is for is to clear any debris and residual material so that it can be cleanly stored. So when they did that and they took another look, the core material had slid down further inside the tube and hindered the visibility. The weather conditions at the time that they were trying to look at it, they were not 100% sure that they got it or if when they shook it, it fell out or anything else had happened. But then when the lighting conditions and the weather had improved in the area on Mars, NASA engineers performed the maneuvers with the camera and the arm and were able to confirm it. And it is now locked away in sample tube number 266, the official serial number, hermetically sealed in the container, ready to go. So very cool stuff.
So now it's going to stay there for, what, a decade?
Yeah, a decade.
For years and years. Until what? I mean, how's it going to get launched back to Earth?
I didn't read about the plan they have to retrieve it. I suppose they're going to send a retriever of some sort to go collect it, pick it up, and bring it back.
Because, interesting.
Hmm. Right, because Perseverance isn't...
Yeah, that's the idea. They have to go get it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they're going to have to grab the Perseverance Gatherer or something to take it out. So that will be a whole set of nerve-wracking things. Like, don't drop it.
Well, theoretically, they could take another sample in 2030 and then still make the deadline. Like, they got like 9 years to get a really, really good sample.
Well, one down, 29 then, more to go. They hope to have 30 of them.
Oh, that's
the
right. They're
going to
get 30. That's right. Okay. All right.
Yep.
All right, so guys, let me ask you a question. What is your gut reaction to this?
Disgust.
Completely eliminating cash.
Fine.
No more, just get rid of cash.
Sure.
Completely.
Yeah, pretty much there already anyway.
Having cash is an anomaly. I guess in a way I don't like it because of how the lack of cash means that we could be tracked with every single thing that we
do. Yeah, that's true.
But we
so
are
why does that
of.
Concern you?
You know, you're buying a gift for your mistress, and people could find out. Oh wait, sorry.
It's not that I have anything to hide, Steve. It's just more about the principle behind it.
Yeah,
cash is dirty.
Like we should be able to have anonymous interactions with anybody we want.
Isn't that Bitcoin?
Well, that's what they say, but I mean, I don't think that the world is going to go on without governments having some type of control over crypto. I mean,
well, that's a fair point. Yep.
All right, so there was a new study looking at the implications of going cashless, and that sent me down the rabbit hole, as it were. What is this all about? How close are we to going cashless? What would be the upside? What would be the downside? And you guys brought up some of the points on either side. So one of the advantages is that it costs money to create and manage cash.
Oh, yeah.
How much does the United States spend managing cash per year?
Hundreds.
$10 billion.
I'll say $600 million a year.
$100 million? $200 billion a year.
What?
$200 wow. billion dollars every
Doesn't
year.
Doesn't sound worth it.
To keep cash in circulation.
Why? Yep.
What the hell? Like,
how much of that
charge?
Is
I'll do it
security.
For $100 billion. Yeah.
That's what it costs. What percentage of transactions in the world are in cash?
Oh, that's a good question. Oh my gosh.
I'd say 50%.
World. I'd say 90%.
Yeah, it's 85%.
80%. 80%. Evan wins.
Hey.
Still most, right? It's 80%. What country is the closest to going cashless?
El Salvador.
That's funny you say that. Evan.
Well, they just went to Bitcoin as their
national
currency.
Yeah, I know.
So that was my guess.
I actually asked myself a similar question.
I'll say the Vatican.
Liechtenstein.
Wait, Steve, let me guess. I'm going to say Sweden.
Sweden is correct.
Nice, Jay. Really?
Sweden and Denmark is second, but Sweden is right now the closest to going cashless. All right, so what would it take? What would it mean? You know, is this a good idea? Is it a bad idea? There's, as you might imagine, upsides and downsides. One of the upsides is, you know, you save a lot of money managing the cash system, right? $200 billion a year for the U.S. Another potential advantage is that it could lower crime rates, right? Mm-hmm. And this, there's some evidence to support this. For example, Missouri at one point started giving their welfare money in digital currency rather than cash, and crime dropped by almost 10%, you know, because people aren't walking around with cash to steal, right? So just, you also can't hit the armored cars carrying millions of dollars of cash.
Yeah, all the thuggery forms of theft. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to put cash into ATMs. There's a lot of infrastructure that's basically moving cash around, and so there's a lot of cost of that as well, but also creates a lot of points of vulnerability for crime. Also, it's much harder to launder money without cash.
Yeah, that's big.
And obviously a lot of criminal activity depends on a cash inflow so that they could launder the money, you know, which if you don't know, that just basically means you have some system of, where the cash has the appearance of being legitimate, right? Like you have a business that makes $100,000 a year, but on paper it makes $1 million a year, and $900,000 is basically drug money that then now is legitimate because it looks like it came from a legitimate business.
Laundering the money.
Yeah, laundering. Okay. Less time and cost associated with handling, storing, and depositing paper money, right? So digital currency is just more convenient, right? I mean, now, like when we are splitting a bill or we're going in on something, do we hand cash around to each other? No, we Venmo each other, right?
Yeah.
It's just more, it's just easier.
Or we ignore each other's requests for money.
And it makes a foreign international exchange easier as well if it's all digital. Because it just happens automatically in the background. You don't have to physically exchange your money for the physical currency of another country. There are some disadvantages, however, as well. It exposes your personal information to possible data breach.
That's right? What so security
is huge. Hackers could steal millions digitally, either from a personal account, mm-hmm. from a business, from a whatever, credit card company. Yeah. So the stakes get higher, because of digital hacking is basically now the new theft. And of course, it can't be used by people who don't have bank accounts or mobile phones or don't have some technological means of managing digital currency,
right?
Which is like half the world, right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The whole world, but like even in industrialized nations, it may be as high as 5-10% of people just wouldn't really have a convenient way of handling digital cash, digital money. And then there's one that comes up in a lot of articles about this, which I think is probably the least concerning for me, is that the psychological thing that it might be easier to overspend if there's no physical transfer of cash involved, if you're just spending money like on a credit card. But that's the kind of thing everyone's got to adapt to,
Yeah.
Like
sounds more generational than
when you buy something with a credit card, you're still spending that same exact amount of money, even though you're not physically handing over cash. Yeah, I don't find that one terribly compelling. The study focuses on one benefit, quote unquote benefit, and I guess this depends on your perspective that I didn't mention, and that is it is easier to collect taxes when you can track every transaction.
Oh yeah,
sure.
It really minimizes the tax using cash for tax avoidance. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? And that was the nature of the study. What would that aspect of going cashless mean for different people? So it definitely would mean increased tax collection, and therefore you could argue that's more fair, because why should people who happen to have a business or a job or something that deals in cash be able to avoid their taxes or avoid a portion of their taxes when people who don't have that option can't, mm-hmm. So there's nothing inherently fair about tax dodging. And of course, it also tends to favor people with more money. But what they said was, the government, like the United States government would definitely be able to collect more tax revenue if they went cashless. And however, this would, that overall would hit low income people worse, not so low that you're not paying taxes, but those people sort of in the lower end of the income, tax paying income range, just because everything does, right? You have less disposable income, et cetera, et cetera. But they said it would be a net advantage if the policy were made revenue neutral. So in other words, if you go cashless and because of that you collect 10% more revenue from taxes and then you decrease the tax rate by 10% overall.
Oh,
you
there
know,
it is.
Right.
You just find the balance point.
Yeah. So that it's, so the whole endeavor is revenue neutral, then that would benefit lower income people because their taxes would go down and they're not the ones who are cheating on their taxes in the first place.
Right.
Right. So it basically would mean that richer people would be able to cheat less on their taxes. And also criminals, you know, let's face it, you know, people who are just engaged in criminal activity, that's why they're using cash. And that, but the tax rate would be able to go down for people who are at the lower end of the economic scale. So this could be, this could reduce income inequality. This could be a net advantage for people of lower incomes if it were done that way. But it all depends on how we do it. So no, another concern that was raised was, okay, what about if we're all dependent on apps and digital cash, et cetera, when most of our money is moving in this way, what happens when we have no option, right? There is no cash option. We have to do this. And then we're a captive audience. Now they start dialing up the fees per transaction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, every time you send somebody money, you're spending, you know, 1% is a fee or whatever, you know, like that we do that now. Like if I PayPal somebody, I may have to pay a fee for that.
Yeah.
So again, it would depend on regulation, like, you know, or would the government need to have an option available for anybody that is free and you don't need to have a bank account or whatever. Like you need to have some way of making it so that anybody can function in a cashless society and without getting ripped off. So it could work, but it's a question of, do you have, you know, faith that it will work? Will the government manage it properly, or will we just get raked over the coals by the tech industry or whatever? Like there's so many things can go wrong, but
yeah,
that's true of any system. It's just a matter of, you have to make it work. Another point that was raised was, you know, questioning, would it really in the long run reduce crime, meaning the criminal's ability to engage in criminal activity because they're not the, they don't have cash. They said, or will they just adapt? Like, for example, this is an interesting idea. One article said, for example, you could use corporate gift cards, right? Here's a $10,000 in Amazon gift cards. That's money, you know, and it's pretty,
I'll take it.
Pretty anonymous. Yeah.
I'll pay $9,000 for that.
But it is true that there's nothing more anonymous than cash. Cash, it's more so than cryptocurrency, or more so than any other currency. Cash is completely 100% anonymous, you know?
Yep.
And people just psychologically, like Jay, I think you don't really have a concrete reason, just psychologically. It's like, yeah, but then you feel like you're giving something up and you're ceding power to industry and government. And even if you don't know why that would injure you, it just feels like it triggers a protective sort of reaction. Interestingly, people have been predicting the death of cash for the last 60 years or more.
Yeah, right.
It's one of those things like the paperless office, you know, it's like always seems to be right around the corner, but it never happens anywhere again. Sweden is getting pretty close, but it's something like 90%+ of all transactions in Sweden are digital. Now cash is very limited. And there is some halfway, you know, in between steps that can be taken. So there's a lot of push, for example, to not eliminate all cash, but to eliminate the large denominations.
Oh, go ahead.
Like, so in the U.S., get rid of the $100
like
bill. Get rid of the $100 bill.
The $100. Yeah, and that has happened before. There used to be $500,000 bills.
Get rid of the $100.
What is that? Bigger.
Get rid of the $50, maybe even get rid of the $20. So basically two things for that. One, especially if you have high denomination bills, like in Europe, they have a 500 euro bill. There's a lot of talk about getting rid of that. Then that makes it convenient to hoard cash.
Right.
Right? You can have $1 million in cash if you have it in $100 bills. It's what makes it a lot easier than if it's in $1 bills. And also it makes it convenient for, again, large criminal enterprises to use cash for currency. Mm-hmm. If, again, you're moving around big bills, you know. If you get rid of the $100 bills, and again, like if as a one-time maneuver, you get rid of $100 bills, you would have lots of criminal organizations around the world who have lots of hoarded cash and $100 bills that suddenly have no way to turn them in because without declaring it, right? so they would kind of be stuck with soon to be worthless $100 bills. But in any case, you could say, listen, if you keep like say $20 and smaller or $10 and smaller denominations, you can still use it for that everyday kind of little things.
Petty cash.
But you're not going to be able to buy cars with it.
Or
it's not efficient for the big things, which tend to be where the vast majority of the abuse and criminal activity happens.
I like that idea.
But again, so that's a very popular idea. It's big. It's been around for a long time. Again, the concern is criminals will just adapt. And
they tend to.
And again, cryptocurrency is one way that they will adapt. They'll just, move over to Bitcoin. So maybe, and ironically, cryptocurrency may be reducing the incentive to go cashless because it gets rid of, the criminal benefit, of going cashless. Although, again, it's interestingly, just by coincidence, not too long ago, I was having a conversation with a friend of ours who's a financial, guru. And he made that point. He's like, the most anonymous currency is cash. And he was saying cryptocurrency is actually not that anonymous. It's totally traceable by definition. It's a digital currency. There has to be some kind of digital
trail.
Digital trail. If you want a 100% anonymous currency exchange, cash is the best way to go. So anyway, it's interesting. It's not something we think about too much. And it's one of those things where like the idea crops up every now and then. Like I've heard of this before, like every few years.
Yeah.
In one context or another, crops up. We never seem to get any closer to it, despite the fact that there's so many options now. And actually, when you look at the numbers, worldwide, we're like nowhere near really being able to make this change. And so I do wonder, and I wonder what you guys think about it. Like, when will we have like a completely cashless society? When will that be, viable, convenient?
When smaller countries or states have proven it works over the course of a generation, probably. So it'll be a few generations away, I think.
I'd put it very far away.
Yeah, there's sort of a technical barrier, and then there's the cultural, psychological barrier. Even when it's technically possible now. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, like, for example, when's the last time I took cash out of my wallet to pay for something?
Yeah.
Before the
pandemic? 2 years. At least, it'd be pre-pandemic. I just haven't used cash since before the pandemic. Not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a pirate skull at the foot of my bed on a table. And for like 5-6 years I fill it up with change. Fill it up with change, and then come October, I've got like $220 in coins that I cash in, turn to cash, and and I haven't cashed it in 2 years.
No,
because I very rarely have a coin that I put in there, and it's actually nearing the top now. It's full almost pretty much now, but it took three, four times longer. It took like 3 years instead of a year. And my biggest problem with getting rid of cash is it would do away forever with the joy, the unadulterated joy you feel, you experience. We've all experienced it. When somebody opens a briefcase and it's filled with cash, that feeling you get is like, imagine if you had that. That would be awesome.
That is a point that people bring up, that there is a psychological attachment to the physicality of coins and bills that you don't get with digital money. That's real. It's because it's tangible, that would make it difficult for people to give up. But I have to say that I think, if you play any kind of video game that has an economy in the game, when you get those digital coins, it feels the same thing. Cause there is some, even though it's virtual, it triggers. And I think look at Vegas, when you play the slot machines, there's no coins dropping. It's just lights, blinking lights.
And credits. And a piece of paper spits out when you're ready to cash out.
Psychologically, to be just fine for people. Mm-hmm. If there's something, some sensory component to it. But again, I think those psychological things we'll adapt to.
Yeah.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Wondrium.
If you're like us on The Skeptic's Guide, then you're probably tired of mindlessly watching and scrolling. You want something new and exciting. That's why we've been loving Wondrium. That's Wondrium. It's the streaming service that our brains cannot get enough of. There's so much to explore. We absolutely love it.
So I'm watching something called Cooking Basics, What Everyone Should Know. Let me give you an example, and this is awesome. Choosing the best method to cook vegetables. Should you peel a vegetable before cooking it or not? Cook it in water, oil. This is the kind of stuff you can learn. Let's say you don't have a skill that you would like. This is the best place to start.
We know you'll love Wondream, so we put together a special offer for our listeners, a free month trial of unlimited access. Just go to our special URL, wondrium.com/skeptics. That's WONDRIUM.com/skeptics. Think of how much you'll learn in a month. Go to wondrium.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. All right. Got a lot of guesses this week. A lot of different stuff people wrote in. So here's one. This is a listener named Chris. And Chris says, "Hi, Jay. This week's noisy sounds like somebody tapping a bridge cable under tension. The wind and sound of water make me think they are standing on the shore below the bridge." A lot of people gave me a variation on this one. And I think that the noise that they're talking about is like the Star Wars blaster sound when you hit a steel cable that's under tension. And there is a little bit of that in there. That is not a correct answer, but definitely can hear a little bit of what Chris is talking about. Another listener named Hagen Wenzik said, "Quick stop during a run in Sleepy Hollow to send my guest the gates to a ferry closing. Heard from the ferry as it pulls away." That was very specific. And I would imagine that Hagen travels on a ferry more than the average person, because I have no idea what that would sound like. But that is not correct. Chris Jones sent in a guess. He said, "Jay, probably is a more obscure thing than I'm imagining, but it sounds a lot like a metal tube pipe rolling across a concrete floor." Funny you should say that, Chris, because I have a two-inch metal tube pipe in the studio, and it's about 2 feet long. I actually got the wrong size pipe. I can't use it, and it's one of those things. I'm like, do I throw it away? What am I doing with this pipe? So anyway, we were cleaning up for Nexus. And I dropped the pipe on the concrete floor, and it nearly knocked me out with how loud it was. It was a profoundly loud noise. So I know that noise very well. And I understand why you wrote that, because there is a little bit of a similarity there, but that is also not correct. The next guest comes from Evil Eye. This is someone that has been guessing Who's That Noisy for a long time. He said, "In my head, I pictured the ocean and a buoy with a bell as a ship passes and the wake rocked the buoy." So it's basically like the buoy picks up the motion from the waves and the bell rings on it. And I understand why you said that. That is not correct. The winner is Edward Burson. Edward wrote in, "Hi, Jay. Listening to the show, and I think I actually know this one. I think this was a stone being dropped down a long pipe in the ground."
Oh.
So now that you know what this is, listen to it again. Mm-hmm. Somebody drops three stones down a pipe, and at the end, you'll hear the stones come out of the pipe and crash into a body of water. Hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So that's the stones very far away dropping into the water. Very cool. I'm really happy somebody guessed that, because I was a little worried that this was unguessable. But somebody got it, so thank you guys for guessing. I have a new noisy for you guys this week. This noisy was sent in by a listener named Ryan Skiba, and here it is.
I know what that is. Somebody trying to talk Slytherin.
Parcel tongue.
So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or you came across an awesome sound, something that you think I need to hear, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay.
Steve, I got some announcements, if you don't mind. The Denver Extravaganza is now formally sold out, but we still have tickets for the Denver Private Show in Colorado and the Fort Collins Private Show in Colorado. So if you're interested, just go to theskepticsguide.org and go to our events page, and you can see the details for that. If you missed Nexus, it's not too late to still buy tickets and watch Nexus online. We will extend the time that those that the video is available. It is two. It's a two-parter for one night for Friday, one for Saturday. So please consider doing that because everything turned out awesome, and we'd love you to watch it. And you can also, if you want to help support the show, you can become a patron. You can go to our Patreon. Go to patreon.com/skepticsguide for more details.
Thanks, Jay. One quick question. Actually, there's a number of different questions I'm going to answer all at once. But this involves our discussion about the electric cars. This is a show that hasn't aired yet, interestingly. I think this is the first time I'm answering a question about a show that we haven't aired yet. But that's for a couple of reasons. One is
Maybe we'll explode.
You don't have to have heard the discussion in order to understand the conversation we're about to have. And two, because a lot of people did see this. So this was, we live streamed our live show to DragonCon last Saturday. So a lot of people did see that. This question comes from that. That episode as a podcast will come out in November. And so just remember this conversation, you know, these questions for that. So this way you don't have to ask these questions. We're pre-answering them. All right. So the discussion was basically about the challenges of turning our automobile fleet over from internal combustion engine to electric cars. And there's a couple of questions that came from that were more than one people for each of these questions had. So one was, you know, because we were talking about the benefit of electric cars varies, depends upon where you're sourcing your electricity from. You know, if you get your electricity from a coal fire plant, it's not as good as if you're getting it from a solar panel. And a couple of people, you know, wanted to point out that, emphasize that electric cars are still advantageous, you know, regardless of the source of the electricity. So I wanted to put some numbers behind that. I found some interesting things. So first, a quick general principle. Whenever you're comparing a short-term disadvantage to a long-term advantage, there's always two ways you can express whether it's worth it or not. With electric cars, it's more expensive to build an electric car because of the battery. It also costs more carbon and more energy. But you obviously, you release less carbon when you're driving it. So you could ask, you know, what's better, you know, therefore EVs or internal combustion two ways, trying to keep other variables constant. One is, what is the lifetime cost of one versus the other? But you could also ask, when do the lines cross? For how long do you have to drive an electric vehicle for the extra upfront cost to be worth it? So focusing on that approach. So there's been a number of studies, and the EPA published a recent study looking at all this data, where they would take an electric vehicle as close as they can get to it in a gas, you know, internal combustion engine vehicle, so that they're, you know, roughly the same, except for the mode of propulsion. And then they say, all right, if you source your energy for the electric vehicle 100% from hydroelectric, basically 100% from a carbon neutral source, how long would you have to drive that car before the total carbon footprint is less than the internal combustion engine? Because again, the carbon footprint, the initial carbon footprint is higher for the electric car, but obviously, the gas car puts out more carbon as you drive it. So what do you guys think? If you were sourcing your electricity from 100% a carbon neutral source?
2 years.
I'm sorry, in miles. How many miles would you have to drive it?
Oh.
Like 30,000 miles.
Yeah, 30,000 would be around my guess.
30,001.
Oh, Baja. Price is riding us.
8,000.
Oh, wow.
I should have gone with 29,999.
Holy moly.
That's great.
So once you drive that EV for 8,000 miles, the gasoline car is releasing more carbon than the total, you know, lifetime of the EV. All right. If you source your electricity from the typical U.S. mix of electricity, so that's 23% coal, 20% nuclear, you know, a lot of natural gas, like 40 or something like that, natural gas, right? So it's like 60-70%. You know, fossil fuel, 20% nuclear, and 10%, yeah, you know, carbon neutral. So if that's your source of electricity, the average U.S. mix, how long do you have to drive it to get to the break-even point?
I'll guess 30 again.
I'll go higher. I'll go 40,000.
25.
13,000.
That's all.
That's it. Just 13,000 miles.
Wow, even with the blend. Huh.
The third analysis was, what, and this is, these numbers vary a little bit based upon car, blah, 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 but this is sort of like a typical figure. The third analysis was, what if you're sourcing your electricity 100% from coal-fired plants?
Worst case scenario.
All you're charging that car up and off of and your local grid is getting off, all of their
30,000 miles.
Why not? I'll do it again.
So, Bob,
say it.
80,000.
Wow.
80,000, Bob, right on the money.
Oh, wow.
80,000.
Nailed it. Oh, that's a huge.
So that's still less than half of a typical lifespan of a car on the road, you know. So even in the worst case scenario, the lifetime carbon emissions for an electric vehicle is less than a gasoline vehicle, even if you're getting all your electricity from coal plants, which of course is not most people. I think the middle figure, the 13,000, is probably by definition where on average people are going to fall, because that's looking at the average mix.
Mm-hmm.
Put solar panels on your house, it's a mere 8,000. So
Wow. Bottom
line is, electric vehicles have a carbon benefit over internal combustion engines, even in the worst case scenario. But of course, we want to get to the best case scenario. We want to be producing our electricity as much as possible from carbon neutral sources. And then the advantages of the electric vehicle go up when you do that. They increase. All right. So a couple of emailers wanted to basically point out that fact. That's partly because electric vehicles are simply more efficient, energy efficient than gasoline. More of the energy goes towards propelling the car than is converted into heat, for example, or waste heat.
Like going with the LED rather than an incandescent.
So, this is hugely dependent on where you're driving your car. In the winter, that heat is actually useful. And you're actually spending energy to heat an electric vehicle, whereas you're just using waste heat to heat the vehicle from the internal combustion engine. So the efficiency benefit of EVs depends greatly on the ambient temperature. Also, batteries get less efficient in colder weather. And you have to spend some energy to precondition the battery before you drive it, or you should be anyway.
That's awesome news.
All right. The second response was that we spoke a lot about driving more efficient, more energy, carbon efficient cars. But shouldn't we be talking about reducing the amount of driving that we're doing? We often get this type of question. I actually don't like that kind of question, because it's a logical fallacy, in my opinion. I mean, the point itself is legitimate, but framing it as a false choice is a logical fallacy. It also could be framed as a nirvana fallacy, like we should be reducing our car driving, not just making them more efficient. That's kind of like we should be fixing poverty rather than treating the effects of poverty thing that came up, like golden rice or fluoridation of water or anything. It's like, this is sort of the Band-Aid logical fallacy, as I like to call it. Sure, it's always good to try to fix these underlying problems or change the culture or whatever, shift things around. But in the meantime, it's also good. These are not mutually exclusive. We should be driving, when you do drive an electric vehicle, right? If you can carpool. I think the idea that, we're going to significantly restructure our society so people drive less is not very feasible in the short term. If you're talking about changing the way people get around cities, it's like, okay, we should be thinking about making cities more pedestrian and bicycle friendly and e-scooter or whatever, and just reduce the amount that people have to drive. Sure, we should maximize public transport. That's another way to do it. HOV lanes is another way to do it. I also think that allowing people to work from home, that's probably the single biggest thing you could do. Imagine if you're able to work from home even one day a week more than the baseline. That's a 20% reduction.
Huge.
Driving. But not only is it a 20% reduction, that's a 20% reduction in rush hour traffic, which improves everybody's efficiency in getting to work, reduces the amount that the amount of gas everybody's burning to get to work. Imagine you could spend 2 days more working from home and 3 days in the office. That's a 40% reduction in commuting and a 40% reduction in rush hour traffic, roughly speaking, right? So that's massive. That's massive.
That would be worth a massive expenditure of money just to get to that point. It'd be worth it just to spend $100 million.
And it doesn't. And I don't think it would require that. It's really just a culture change. You know, 85% of people have a job that where it's possible for them to do some of their work from home. So not it's not 100% of people, but a lot of, you know, a large percentage of people could potentially be doing some of their work from home. This increases job satisfaction, increases productivity. You know, businesses worry, well, how do we know people are working at home? We should try. If you track their productivity, people are actually more productive at home, you know, than in the office. And, you know, just there's so many efficiencies to be gained there. So I really hope that's one positive thing that comes out of the pandemic is this shift towards a significant leap, you know, working from home. Yeah. So if you want to reduce driving time, you should really be a strong advocate of
pandemics,
working from home. No, absolutely. But like where we live, guys, like, you know, other than, you know, my ability to work from home, you know, there's no way to reduce my driving.
Yeah.
I don't live within walking distance of anything. There's just no way.
That's right. You know, yeah. Connecticut.
That's what, you know, the suburbs are like.
Right. It would take a digital revolution beyond anything we've seen to make that change.
Mm-hmm.
Like upload your mind and live in the virtuality and that'll do it.
Yeah. So some people say, yes, well, you can redesign communities so that you do have things within walking distance. You know, you basically have a cluster of homes around a school, a library, a local store, blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay,
great.
That's a massive infrastructure change.
Right.
You're going to redesign the suburbs. That's not going to happen overnight. In the meantime, we'll drive. I'll use my solar panels to power up my electric car. Thank you. Okay. Let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real, 1 fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. No theme this week, just 3 news items. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
All right, here we go. Item number 1, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has officially approved a set of almost 1,000 medical emoji for communication with patients who are deaf, speak a foreign language, or are medically unable to speak. Item number 2, scientists describe a new Cambrian species, Titanochorus gainesi, an insect ancestor half a meter long and closely related to a 2-meter long predator. In the Cambrian, right? A 2-meter long Cambrian predator. And item number 3, scientists have developed a membrane that could potentially be used to efficiently source lithium from the oceans, which contains 5,000 times as much lithium as land. Evan, go first.
The first one about the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services officially approving a set of almost 1,000 medical emoji. Sure. Yes. I don't see a problem with that. I suppose the reason this could potentially be a fiction is maybe it's only 100 medical emoji, but 1,000? Yeah, you could definitely. You can put 1,000 different things into symbology like that, no doubt about it. You can probably even go higher than that, and they've officially approved the first 1,000. So I don't have a problem with that one. The second one about I'm not even going to pronounce this thing, but an insect ancestor half a meter long, all right, closely related to a 2-meter long predator. Whoa, Darth Vader was 2 meters long. Yeah, okay. The Cambrian species, huh? Cambrian explosion, right? How long? That's 600 million years?
Yeah, this species I'll give you is like 500 million years.
500 long. Million?
Yeah.
Okay. How big were things back then? Pretty big. I think a lot of oxygen going on, right? Large things crawling all around. Okay, I don't think I have a problem with this one per se because I know so little about the Cambrian species in general. And the last one about developing a membrane. Scientists potentially have developed a membrane that could potentially be used to efficiently source lithium from the oceans, which contains 5,000 times as much lithium as land. Yeah, I think they've been trying to get lithium from the ocean. I don't think that's new. It is a source, but have they done it? Developed a membrane Okay. They all seem very plausible. I think, though, I'm going to have to make a guess. I know the least about the Cambrian one, so maybe it is this Cambrian one that'll be the fiction. All right, I'll say the insect ancestor one is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
All right, starting from the bottom, the membrane. Yeah, I like this. I think we definitely could have made a membrane that could sort lithium from the oceans. It makes sense. Cambrian species to what is that? Titanocoris gainesi. Yeah, I like it. I'm going to go with it. I've got a problem with number one, 1,000 medical emoji. To me, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, how many emojis do I have in my damn phone? 100, 120? I could spend forever trying to find the shit I want to find to send. And some of them are ambiguous. And I think an ambiguous medical emoji could probably be deadly. And if you're deaf, so, okay, you could type. I mean, texting shouldn't be a problem for anyone, even if someone's deaf. I mean, I would think they would be more reliant on texting as a form of communication. And if you speak a foreign language, so we got apps. We got translation apps that are awesome. And they'll be much more accurate than people trying to find a specific emoji for compound fracture or I drank ammonia. I mean, those, to me, it's just too risky. And 1,000 of them, that sounds like way overkill. I mean, can you imagine searching through 1,000 emojis trying to find exactly what the problem, like, I can't breathe. And by the time you find it, you're dead. So that's fiction.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And Jay.
Feel strongly about that one.
I mean, I'm agreeing with you, Bob. 1,000 emojis is a lot of emojis. I would think that there's probably, I mean, how many emojis do you think exist right now that are approved? You know, that are like, I mean, I don't know. I don't know, but I mean, 1,000 sounds like a hell of a lot of emojis.
I know exactly how many there are.
Okay, so let me just, you know, I'm kind of agreeing with Bob. The Cambrian species, how do you pronounce that, Steve? Titanocoris?
Yes.
To say Titanocoris.
Titanocoris, huge bug. Yes, these things existed. Absolutely. Some of us, you know, come from these bugs. Evan, I mean, I don't have enough information in my head to really cut through this 2-meter-long predator. That's scary. That's a long bug. But yeah, you know, that's what things were supposed to be like that back in the old days. So let's go down to number three. Scientists developed this membrane to source lithium from the oceans. Yes, there is a ton of lithium in the ocean. This membrane would be able to pull out the lithium. I mean, I would think that this is science. It seems totally cromulent to me, and I would definitely see companies putting money into developing such membrane. So yes, I agree with that. So I'm going to go with Bob, and I'm going to say that the 1,000 medical emojis is suspect.
All right, so you all agree on the third one, so we'll start there. Scientists have developed a membrane that could potentially be used to efficiently source lithium from the oceans, which contains 5,000 times as much lithium as land. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yes.
Get that lithium. We need it.
Oh yeah, 5,000 times as much in the oceans as is on the land.
Wow.
So,
and we need
that's
it.
A lot. And, you know, lithium isn't rare. Like, there's quite a bit of lithium around. Obviously, if we're going to try to build millions of electric vehicles with lithium-ion batteries,
yep,
you know, even the lithium that exists, it's also, you know, lithium could be expensive to extract. And so if we could not only tap into this source of, you know, much greater source of lithium, but also get it cheaper, that could have a huge impact on the electric vehicle industry. So what the scientists developed was a membrane that allows lithium ions to pass through it, lithium chloride, specifically quicker than sodium. Sodium is, there's a lot more sodium in the ocean.
Right.
And so that's just, the trick is separating the lithium from the sodium. This uses a ligand that binds the sodium but doesn't bind the lithium. And so the lithium passes through the membrane much more quickly. And so you could use it to isolate the lithium from the sodium. It's not a finished product yet. That's why I said potentially. It's just a sort of a proof of concept. Yeah, this works. You know, this does what we want it to do. Now, developing it into a as you say, scale it up to industrial use so that it could actually work in a cost-effective way. The problem is, the big problem is that while that's a lot of lithium, the oceans are huge, yeah. and that's extremely dilute. That's not a lot per any, you know, amount of seawater. Yeah, so it's 0.2 parts per million, 0.2 parts per million concentration of lithium in the oceans.
Yeah, that's less.
So one land. Per 5 million.
But this technology in general, just, you know, figuring out how to isolate specific elements from the, you know, from the ocean. Also, it could be a way of sourcing lots of other things like gold and uranium.
You could get quite rich if you had a gold membrane.
And yttrium.
And, you know, uranium. There's more uranium in the ocean than there is in the world. Yeah, so this, you know, just generally speaking, perfecting this technology would be huge. And also, you know, if you could get it so that it's cheaper than having to mine it from the earth, you know, it could also be hugely advantageous. So good to see some progress being made here. Not there yet.
Not there.
But a nice little milestone. Okay, we'll just take these in reverse order. Scientists describe a new Cambrian species, Titanochorus gainesi, an insect ancestor half a meter long and closely related to a 2 meter long predator. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Jay, you think this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
Science.
Yeah, baby. Yes.
Sorry.
Creepy.
It's interesting. Jay and Evan, you both said, yeah, things were bigger in the past. That is a bias. That's not true. And it's...
You can't prove that.
It's an example of people do this. They basically, they smush everything in, quote unquote, the past. And into one era, right? Everything that happened in the past was happening basically all at the same time. And whatever's true of any time in the past is true of every time in the past. It's kind of like how we think about the future.
No,
like the future is one time in the future. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the Cambrian, so the Cambrian was the first appearance of multicellular creatures in the fossil record.
Right.
But we'll put the Ediacaran fauna aside, right? So this is the first clearly multicellular creatures that led to modern life, that, you know, was continuous to extant life. The ancestors of all, you know, living multicellular creatures were in the Cambrian.
Yeah.
Actually, the vast majority of species that we've identified in the Cambrian were teeny tiny, millimeter, centimeter size. This thing is massive. This was the whale of its time, being half a meter long. Now, do you guys, I know you've heard of the 2 meter long predator I'm talking about. I don't know if you remember, but we've talked about it on the show. Anybody dredge up this name? The giant predator of the Cambrian? Anomalocaris.
Anomalocaris.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, because it's an anomaly. It's weird looking. So it's a relative. Awesome. These are in the same group, which makes sense because this is a group of giant, you know, Cambrian, are basically the precursors of the arthropods.
So wait, were these on land or in the ocean, Steve?
Ocean. They're all in the ocean.
Is it made of lithium?
Yeah, so the thing's really cool looking. It has, it's like two-thirds head, and its head is this giant carapace. Kind of looks like a spaceship. And then behind it is like a fluted tail, and that's the whole thing. Anomalocaris is that creature that has, like, again, a long body with lots of, like, horizontal fins, two giant eyes, and those curling down mandibles. I don't know if you guys can picture that, but you would recognize it, I think, if you saw it. And, Jay, this is interesting. So there's also another large Cambrian arthropod precursor in this group.
Yeah, you know, Curvilinchus?
That looks like the Millennium Falcon.
What? Oh. Really cool.
Yeah.
Is that where they got? No, that's not where they got the design.
No. This was named after. It's like Falcony because it was specifically named after the Millennium Falcon because it looks like it. The carapace.
Oh, really?
The carapace because
Star
carapace.
Wars geeks, man.
Yeah, so it looks kind of like the Millennium Falcon. So this group is known as the Radiodonts. Primitive arthropods known as the Radiodonts.
Donts.
Yeah, Anomalocaris, Titanochorus, and Millennium Falcon looking guy.
That would make a good band name.
Millennium Falcons.
But these were collectively the whales of the Cambrian. Okay, all of this means that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has officially approved a set of almost 1,000 medical emoji for communication with patients who are deaf, speak a foreign language, or are medically unable to speak. Is the fiction but not for any of the reasons that you guys
really
said. Yes, because
really?
This is,
well, I don't care
what this was a comment saying that we need to develop medical emojis because of how useful they would be.
I disagree.
So first of all, well, I'll explain to you why you're wrong. So first of all, how many emojis are there? And this is the Unicode standard.
Oh, gosh. I don't know.
As of 2020, there were 3,521 emoji in the Unicode standard. 3,521. And these are official, right? You know how emoji, you have to submit it, and then it has to get approved. There, right now, there are currently 30 medical emojis, and mostly body parts, but also like, you know, a stethoscope, a healthcare worker, a pill, a syringe. A
virus has to be in there too, right?
Virus, yep, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And they're saying these are really useful and we should develop a set of official specific medical emoji to facilitate communication. Now, Bob, you're just thinking, you've never worked in a hospital, you're not a medical clinician, so you don't know how useful this would be. So like, for example, with like deaf patients, so what I need to communicate to them, and in an emergency situation, there's nobody to translate or to sign or whatever. This could be, you know, this could be a useful option. Or it happens all the time where you have somebody who doesn't speak English, you know, like in an American hospital. Sometimes I've had cases where we didn't even know what language they were speaking. We had a patient who spoke a foreign language and nobody knew what it was.
Yeah, but I don't think that's really that important anymore with these translation apps. You don't even need to know what language it is. I mean, I think that's going to become increasingly unimportant.
It may be, but for right now, it is still important because I guarantee you there's no translation app that knew this language. It was like literally 50 people in the world speak this guy's language from some, you know, remote place, whatever. Seriously, and there's like, this would not be covered by a translation app. And also, medical translation's hard, and you know, you would need specifically a medical translation app that would know how to. Getting lost in translation, as you say, could be fatal. You know, could be very consequential. You know, like in the clinic, we have to use.
So rely on these little vague images that could mean, you know, multiple things.
Well, that's the point, is that they're developing images that are not vague and are not ambiguous and mean one thing. First of all, this is also already used in that we use a lot of visual boards, iconography, to communicate to patients. They may be intubated and they can't speak, for example, and they need to communicate to us. So it's not a language issue. They have no way of communicating to us. So it's like point on the board and there's 40 things. What do you need? Are you thirsty? Are you having pain? Are you whatever? And so that's a sort of a crude way of allowing a patient who cannot speak to communicate to the healthcare staff. This would be a way of doing it on a much more nuanced, more a level where it's like covering a much greater range of possible things that they would need to communicate. And like finding the right one, you could have them categorized, Bob. I mean, you know, 1,000 would not be a lot. Here are all the orthopedic ones. Here are all the ones that you might want to communicate to your nurse. Here's all the ones that have to deal with cardiac issues or whatever. Here are all your complaints. Here are the ones that deal with pain. So you could definitely, like, going even like a 2 layers deep sort of categorization would be easy to get to the set of emojis that you need. And then you could have the frequently used ones, you know, at the top, whatever. That is not a deal breaker. So I do think that this is going to happen. It's sort of already happening in a limited way. I kind of just chose 1,000 out of my butt because that was a fiction, you know. And I chose a high number that was just on the edge of plausibility, you know, so that you would think maybe it's too high. That's why it's a fiction. But it's not crazy. And there probably will be hundreds of them at least. It would be my expectation.
So how many emojis are there?
I told you 3,521. 3,521 as of 2020 in the Unicode standard. 30 of which are considered relevant to medicine.
So are these by definition comparable in size to the ones on typically on a phone? Or do they have higher res, slightly bigger ones
I think they're standard. They're standard emojis, but you could display them any way you want. You could display them bigger. If you look at the ones they have, it's really unambiguous what they are. Here's an ear. You know, here's a stethoscope. Higher resolution wouldn't help. Here's a tooth. Mm. No, I think it's an interesting idea.
Yeah, like going from doctor to patient for sure. Not so much for a patient to doctor.
Both ways is important.
It's, you know, it's easier to translate patient to doctor than doctor to patient. Because if you're translating patient, I mean, if you're translating doctor to patient, then you got to know those terms and you got to know, you know, you
so you're making a couple of false assumptions. Let me just cut you off and correct you there. So first of all, physicians don't speak in technical terms to patients, right? We speak in everyday understandable language, but we are translating the technical concepts that we're trying to communicate into everyday language. The problem is...
Right. That's why a translator would need to know that.
It's just as hard to go from patient to doctor. In fact, it's harder in many cases because I'm used to communicating this way, right? I'm used to communicating these concepts to a patient and putting it in a way that's understandable. And I have a lot of experience anticipating how things get misinterpreted or it could be interpreted differently. I say things multiple ways, triangulating to the precise concept that I'm trying to get across.
Mm-hmm.
And patients are horrible communicators in general, mm-hmm. because people are horrible communicators, and they're in a situation that they're not necessarily familiar with. They may be intimidated. They're being asked to think about things in a way that maybe they've never thought about before, and they just give really muddled, confusing, tangential answers. Mm-hmm. And I've had translators like have a conversation with the patient before giving me their answer. Like getting
10 minutes
them
of conversation. Close. Yes.
Yeah.
No, seriously, because this is what they part of what they have to do. They don't have to have a conversation with me because I communicate very precisely.
Yeah.
And in language that the patient should be able to understand. But again, I might be using words or ideas or analogies or whatever that makes sense in the context of my culture and my language and may be challenging to translate into the culture and the language of the patient. But also they're right. expressing things in ways that like don't have a one-to-one translation and they have to make me understand what the patient is saying. So you can't just assume that it's going to, like they need to know some kind of technical lingo in order to be able to translate what a doctor's saying, because we don't talk that way anyway to patients. We actually know how to speak more precisely. We should anyway, if you have experience. Whereas patients, man, they could be so tangential. I mean, it's just amazing sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Bring in mom.
they want to tell you their life story.
Bring in mom to the doctor. I mean, I'm glad nobody is counting eye rolls. because it's like, oh, here we go with
there's
this
an eye roll
again.
Emoji.
Like, mom, irrelevant. Mom, he doesn't need to hear that story. Please don't tell it again.
I know. Anyway, interesting. We'll see. Again, maybe it'll be obsolete by other technology by the time it gets developed, but I bet you it will be, at least in some situations, it'll be one more thing to fall back on if that could be helpful. And again, we already use some level of iconography. This would just formalize it and make it more detailed and useful, probably.
Yep. Plus, I want.
Yeah. Good job, Bob and Jay. Evan, give us a quote.
P-hacking quote. Greater understanding of p-hacking among investigators, journalists, peer reviewers, and consumers of scientific literature will promote more responsible research, methodologies, and analyses. Written by David Weinberg, a vitreoretinal surgeon. Did I pronounce mm-hmm. that right?
Yep.
Vitreoretinal surgeon, professor of ophthalmology at the Medical College of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
Yes.
And a contributor to science-based medicine, which is where I pulled mm-hmm. this quote from.
No, p-hacking is a core concept. If you're involved in research or if you're reading studies to translate into clinical practice, we've talked about it before. Mm-hmm. We can't go into a big description of it. It's basically things that you do that could make a study into a false positive study, and you need to actively avoid doing it. But right. you need to know what it is before you can actively avoid doing it.
There you go.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
You got it, man.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions. dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.